Hello, everybody, and welcome to Vampires Never Get Old, a podcast about vampires in literature, hosted by myself, Zoraida Cordova, and...
I am Natalie C. Parker.
Excellent. And this is our first podcast together, Natalie.
Yes, it is. I don't remember any others.
I do have a podcast called Deadline City. So if you're coming to us from Deadline City, thank you so much for listening. We will be discussing all things that go bump in the night. And Danielle will be on a future episode talking about her short story, The House of the Black Sapphires, which is fantabulous. As for us, we have a vampire anthology called Vampires Never Get Old. 11 Tales with Fresh Bite, or is it just Tales with Fresh Bite?
Oh, gosh. Let's look that up.
We should look that up. It would be nice if we knew that. But
always good when you know the title of your own book.
I know. That happens to me more oftentimes than not.
Right? It's Tales with Fresh Bite.
Tales with Fresh Bite. Okay. And so our anthology comes out September 22nd, 2020. And the reason we decided to do this podcast is so that we can talk about vampires with each one of our contributors. So it is a podcast anthology and an anthology anthology.
Exactly. We wanted to give our anthology contributors an opportunity to talk about some of the vampires that they have loved in literature, maybe that they read as young adults. So we invited everyone to pick their favorite novel and asked everyone to pick a novel from about 1990 up through around 2010. We're probably going to fudge a little bit on those dates, but also that gives us an opportunity to talk about how YA as a genre or as a grouping of literature was changing in the run up to Twilight and then after Twilight, which of course published in 2005.
Yeah, and we often talk about Twilight as a game changer. So it's been interesting to reread a lot of these books. I just had such a trip going back, especially the books that we're going to talk about. But first, for those of you who are new to both Natalie and myself, we will tell you about each other. Or we will tell you about ourselves.
Okay, I didn't know if we were going to, you know, test each other's knowledge on... Do I even know who you are, Zoraida?
Do you? Let's see. Natalie Parker is the author of many books, including the Seafire Trilogy, which is Mad Max Fury Road on the open seas in a post-apocalyptic world, futuristic world.
Yeah, go with it.
Yeah, where a group of pirates, lady pirates, are trying to bring down a warlord and get revenge for all of their families and each other. And also Beware the Wild, which is a swamp goth novel. That's what I call it.
That's good. I like it.
Yeah. And you are also the co-owner of Madcap Retreats, which is a writer's retreat company, which I love to go to and drink on the beach at.
In the times before COVID, when such things were possible. Right now, it's a little difficult to have those kinds of retreats.
I am a deep frowning right now.
I know. Me too. And Zoraida Cordova is a land mermaid who is seeking the correct magic spell that will return her to her true origins as an ocean mermaid, where she will probably find true love and rule the seas.
That is the most accurate author bio that I've ever had.
So Zoraida Cordova is also the author of many, many books, including a trilogy about mermaids, The Vicious Deep, which, gosh, did that come out in 2007? Wait, when
did
you publish
those
books?
No, I published it in 2012.
Okay, 2012. So were those your first books?
That was my first novel. The Vicious Deep was my first novel.
That's what I thought I remembered that, but then I feel like you have published so many novels that surely I'm missing some.
I know. By the time that Wayward Witch, the third book in the Brooklyn Brewhouse trilogy, comes out in September, I think that will be my 15th novel.
Jeez.
So.
That is so many novels. I'm definitely not going to be able to list them all, but the Vicious Deep trilogy kicked everything off. You write some romance under the pen name Zoe Castile, and those, there's at least a trilogy out there, probably more because I can't keep track. Oh, sorry. There's just a trilogy. And most recently, you're the author of the Brooklyn Brujas trilogy, which is a set of stories about three sisters, each with different magical abilities and each with their own pieces of adventures, some of which involve zombies, some of which involve fairylands. And also the Incendiary duology, which just launched this past May, April? April.
Yeah, April 20. Oh, yeah, close to May, April 28th.
Which is a high fantasy inspired by the Spanish Inquisition or those times.
Yeah.
And you've also stepped into middle grade ground recently with the release of The Way to Rio Luna, which is a charming, most adorable tale about a young boy who desperately, desperately wants to believe in magic. And when his sister goes missing, decides that the way to find her really is to keep believing in magic. And he gets swept up in some
shenanigans.
Super fun adventures.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did I list all of them?
That's pretty good. That's excellent. And I also wrote a Star Wars novel, but.
Oh, Star Wars. Yeah. My gosh. See, I knew I would miss some.
No, but that's fine. I think that we've got each other pretty covered. So that's who we are. And our anthology, do you want to tell our listeners about Vampires Never Get Old and sort of how we came up with it?
I do. Vampires Never Get Old was born at a writing retreat where Zoraida and I were just sort of kicking around ideas and talking about young adult and the ways that we see different kinds of not only mythical creatures, but stories tend to sort of move in and out of fashion in young adult literature. And we both realized at the same minute that we sincerely missed vampire fiction. And this was maybe going on 2 years ago now. And we immediately started discussing what we would want to see in vampire fiction if it were to have a resurgence in YA, which clearly it is having now.
Mm-hmm.
And we agreed that what we wanted to see was a different kind of vampire. We wanted to see vampires move out of the strikingly handsome, white, hetero, cis vision of vampiric power into different spaces. And so I think right then and there, we started making up a list of who our dream contributors would be to this anthology. Like, who did we want to see breaking the mold of vampire stories? And
We got them.
Our list is pretty true to who appears in this anthology collection right now. So
yeah. And so the contributors of this anthology are
Samira Ahmed, Danielle Clayton, Tessa Grattan, Heidi Heilig, Julie Murphy, Mark Oshiro, Rebecca Roanhorse, Laura Ruby, Victoria Schwab, and Kayla Whaley, in addition to a co-authored story from myself and Zoraida Cordova.
Yep. And you're going to be able to hear from each one of those authors on one of the episodes. And we're just going to talk about all the things we love about vampires and each one of the characters that we have. So today we are going to talk about The Silver Kiss by Annette Curtis Claus, which is one of my favorite vampire novels from the 90s.
You know what's interesting about this one is that I think I had it on my shelf for a really long time. And I definitely did not read it in the 90s. I was aware of it, but reading it for this podcast was my first experience with The Silver Kiss.
Oh my God. I remember my first memory with The Silver Kiss was back when I was in high school. I was with my best friend at the time, and we had just left the Barnes and Noble in Forest Hills, Queens. And I bought The Silver Kiss because I had just finished reading Amelia Atwater Rhodes's In the Forest of the Night, which we will also talk about in a future episode. The next step was, even though In the Forest of the Night came out 9 years after The Silver Kiss, I was still just discovering it. So my next step was like finding all the vampire romance fiction in the newly formed teen section at Barnes and Noble. And she lost the book. She left it in the park. I had to rebuy it. She bought it for me again. So it's like the universe just didn't want me to read about Simon and Zoe from the get-go. But then I got my hands on it. And you know what? I still have really fond memories of this book. But upon rereading it, you know, it's been 15 years, between 10 and 15 years since the last time I read it. So the experience is certainly different, because I'm now 33 instead of 13. And I understand why I loved it so much, because it is about a young girl whose mom is dying from cancer, and she meets this boy named Simon at the park. Well, they see each other at the park one night, because she likes to go walking at night by herself to think. And for me, that was revolutionary, because I was not allowed to leave my house. So I was like, she's allowed to just, her dad doesn't care that she's at, it's 10 p.m. and she's just like walking around the place. So it was just such a different experience for me, being from New York, where it's like you don't leave your house ever except for going to school.
This is like the suburban trust of of your surroundings.
Yes. And so she sees this like moonlit boy, he notices her, and he's instantly attracted to her as well, because they both lost their mothers. So they bond over that.
Excuse me, Zoraida.
What?
They bond over losing their mothers. Do you remember what happens in this book after he sees her in the park that night? Let me tell you what happens. He follows her home, and he doesn't understand the swirling maelstrom of emotion inside of him. So he pees on her doorstep, marking it. And
I don't remember that.
It's a quote. He's like, I marked it like an animal so that nobody else would feel like they could go into her house. So this is how he manages his emotions when he sees her and is struck by her. He pees on her house, Zoraida.
I know he pees on her house.
I couldn't believe it. I stopped reading and
you texted me.
I texted you, and then I had to read the line like 3 or 4 more times just to make sure that I understood what I was reading. And it is there. He pees on her house. That's how you know it's love.
That's how you know it's love. There's also a theme about what is animalistic and what is human, right? Because Simon has been alive for hundreds of years, and he has been alone. Okay. His loneliness is reflected in Zoe's loneliness, because her best friend is moving away. 2, her mom's in the hospital. 3, she's like, Dad, you wish that you monopolize time with mom now that she's sick, because you wish I wasn't here. And you just want her last moments to be with you. And so the only person who understands her is this boy who is described as, excuse me, He was young, more boy than man, slight and pale, made elfin by the moon. He noticed her and froze like a deer before the gun. They were trapped in each other's gaze. His eyes were dark, full of wilderness and stars, but his face was ashen, almost as pale as his silver hair. And that is the first time she sees him. And this is the person who mirrors her darkness and solitude and pain.
That's true. It is. I have to admit that I thought that it was a really smart way of heightening the feelings, like some of the existential feelings you have as a teen. Mm-hmm. But to drive that up to an extreme level by
peeing.
No. By isolating her, not only because her mother is sick and dying and her father is trying to figure out how to deal with that. And when I think about it, especially in terms of the 90s and yeah. experiences with cancer in the 90s and how much less was known then, and she didn't even have access to the internet. So like her isolation and confusion around her mother's illness is so much more than what we might experience today, because anybody whose mother gets sick and who knows how to use the internet is probably going to seek some answers on their own, but she literally cannot and is barred from seeking those answers, or her father doesn't know how to give them to her, or maybe is afraid to tell her too much. And he's constantly pushing her out of the hospital and sending her home alone. And then at the same time, her best friend comes and tells her that she's moving away in 2 weeks. So this timeline of the eventual extreme isolation is really quite oppressive throughout the book. Like mm-hmm. it gives you a real sense of that panic and the emotional walls that are starting to go up for her, so that when she meets someone who wants to give her their full attention, it makes complete sense that she would fall in with this vampire. And what I think is really cool about this book in particular, especially in comparison to some of the ones that we're going to talk about later, is that Annette Claus really stuck with many of the familiar pieces of vampire lore. So he can't go out in the sunlight. He travels with a little suitcase of the dirt where he would have been buried, so that, you know, and he sleeps on top of it. So like he's not in a coffin, but he has to find a place where he can block out the sun. And then he has to sort of cuddle up with his suitcase of grave dirt so that he can sleep. And he's also
he turns into mist.
He turns into mist and he has a hard time with running water, and sort of explains it as like being at odds with the natural world, which I thought was pretty neat.
So, yeah. I really like that. I like the way that he describes himself, saying that nature has a problem with him because he is unnatural. Right. And I thought it was, when I was rereading this, I was like, oh my God, he keeps asking her to, if he could come inside her house because he needs an invitation. And so while her dad is gone, she invites him in and they just start making out on the couch. And
they did.
And he like, but there's not a lot of like a prelude to it.
No, which, it was definitely, I had to reread the passage because I was like, wait, they're kissing now?
Yeah. And so, but first he bites her and then she wipes away the blood and then they start kissing again. And then he feeds from her and she's like, she loves it. She's like, she enjoys the sensation of having been bitten. But it doesn't cause her pain. She doesn't say that it hurts. So it's like a weird metaphor for it is a metaphor for sex to me, because they never actually have sex. So to me, that was like when I was a teenage girl reading this.
No, they have sex. There is a fade out in this book.
Fade out.
They, they are definitely having sex. It's just not on the page.
Right.
There's like right before they go to confront his evil brother.
Oh, right. So let's talk about the evil brother, because this book uses sibling relationships, and in a future book, which we're going to talk about, there's also this like sibling relationship. I love the use of sibling relationships. I think that I like to have mine sort of try to save each other instead of try to kill each other. So the premise is Simon and Christopher are brothers. Simon got turned when he was older, a teenager, while Christopher got turned, even though he's the older brother, got turned when he was a kid. So yeah,
he got turned first.
Mm-hmm, and then went away, returned, killed their mom, and then tormented his brother when he got older. And so they've spent the last few years, somehow they wind up in suburban Oregon at the same, naturally, where you go for the hotbed of vampire activity. And then they have this like cat and mouse game where Simon is hunting him, and Christopher uses the ploy of being a lost boy, like a little lost albino boy with a teddy bear, to lure women in and murder them, which was actually really gruesome and terrifying. And I'm just like, oh, this like creepy children in horror just mess me up no matter what. I think that it's always going to be a scary thing. But I didn't remember Christopher before my reread. I only ever remembered Simon, and I was like, sure, there's a plot, but
I don't know what it is. There's something about kissing.
Yeah. Cancer, but maybe. All I remembered was the actual silver kiss. So yeah, that's my recollection.
Yeah. I think Christopher is really interesting. This was published, this would have been after Interview with a Vampire. So we already had Claudia as an example of the vampire turned when they were still a child, and how extra creepy that is, because the sort of the promise of the vampire is that blissful, powerful immortality. But there is a scenario in which I think we all sort of recoil at the idea of being immortal, and that's the idea of being trapped in a body that you don't want. Like the body of a child, as your mind in particular, continues to gain age and wisdom. And so the idea that you carry of yourself is definitely mismatched with the body that you're in.
Yeah. Yeah. That's scary to me.
And I think so. The child vampire has an extra edge of horror, not only because children, ghosts or zombies or vampires, you know, anytime you use child in a horror scenario, there is that extra edge of creepiness because they are supposed to be something you protect, not something that attacks you. But when you combine it with that the idea of being immortal, I think that there's something even creepier to it.
Yeah. So what do you think that this to me is, as far as our recollection of young adult vampire fiction, this is my first, it wasn't my first read, but it is one of the first vampire novels in the teen space. Correct?
As far as I know, I think this was one of the early ones in the teen space, and this would have been published before there was technically a teen space. So in the 90s, bookstores hadn't broken it out into the young adult section that we're familiar with today. So this would have been just sort of tucked in the children's section, and they might have divvied it up by general age range within the kids section, but I'm not entirely sure in the 90s that they were doing much. I don't think it was very granular. So
no, because I started going into the libraries and I searched for these books It was like, but it was 99, 2000. Mm-hmm. And the author, Annette Curtis Claus, who also wrote one of my favorite novels, Blood and Chocolate, she said that when she was 14 years old, she read a book called The Shiny Narrow Grin by Jane Gaskell. And that was a vampire novel about I haven't read it and I haven't been able to find it. But it's a vampire novel, which she describes in the introduction to the Kindle version, the digital version of the Silver Kiss Anniversary Edition. The Shiny Narrow Grin is described as a book about a young human girl who is so vapid, everyone is attracted to her, even though she makes people miserable. And so this vampire is attracted to her, because she's so shallow and so like vapid. But it was considered vampire. It was considered a teen book or a children's book before teen literature also existed. So this must have been in the 60s or something like that. So even though I think Annette Curtis Claus, The Silver Kiss, was the first teen vampire novel in that space, Annette Curtis Claus believes that there's one preceding her, which I think is interesting.
I think that in the early 90s, there were a handful of vampire novels that probably came out around the same time. It would be really interesting to put them together on some kind of a publication timeline so we could actually track where the trajectory of the YA vampire. So this one, The Silver Kiss, is 1990, but so was The Vampire Diaries. The very first Vampire Diaries was 1990.
That's true. I always forget about that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's a few more that I'm not thinking of. But of course the Last Vampire, which is what we'll discuss in the next episode, was 1990. Yeah. In the future. That was 1994. So I wouldn't be surprised to find that there were a cluster of vampire novels that came out in the early 90s.
What do you think led to this, right? Like, I think that socially, when it comes to literature, themes recycle or return would probably be a better way to describe it. So why do you think vampire in the teen space works so well? I know the answer to my theory.
Wait, what are you asking me?
Why do you think that these books clustered during this time?
I think there was a lot of different kinds of horror, young adult horror being published in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Most famously, Christopher Pike and R.L. Stine. And those books came out so quickly and they were easy to read and easy to pass on, just the little paperbacks. And there was always some kind of new, magical, mystical, or even just real life sort of horror element in those. So I think that in the early 90s, there was a popularity to the horror novel or the horror story. Yeah. I don't know. I want to know your answer, because the only other thing I can think of is that Interview with a Vampire came out in 1974, and then the movie came out, but I am not sure that it was out as of 1990.
Yeah, I mean, I also, you know, Buffy started, the film Buffy was 1992, I'm pretty sure. The movie was 1992, the TV show started in 1997. So I think that, I feel like, one, vampires have always been part of our zeitgeist, and that's something that we have been trying to answer for a long time. Like, we've been trying to answer why vampires, why are they always on the surface of our culture, and when they're not on the surface, they're in the back of our minds, and people still love them, right? I think that for teen fiction, when teen fiction was darker than it is now, you know, everybody talks about in the last few years, like the darkness in YA. And I'm like, have you even read YA in the 90s? Do you even read 90s YA, bro?
Do you know where we came from?
Yeah. And I'm like, here are these scenes with, you know, the squirrel inviting a a strange boy who looks like death into her, you know, into her, her house so that she can make out with him and have him bite her, and killing his brother in the middle of the street, you know, in a very brutal way. And just sort of all of the things that represent this, that to me reflects the turmoil of the teen, right? Of that time period. But you see young adult vampires change, and we will note that as we do more of these episodes, right? Look at the way that tonally something changed in Twilight. How long it is. These books are 200 pages in a mass market paperback form, right? Twilight is a standard hardcover, and it is like 500 pages. So everything from tone to format to the mythology kept evolving and changing. And those are some things that we'll keep discussing, as we point them out. But do you have any last thoughts on the Silver Kiss?
Oh, you know what? My only other thought on the Silver Kiss is just a warning to anybody who has never read this book and wants to read this book. If you do pick up an edition that has the new foreword in it, do not read the foreword. I don't know what they were thinking putting that before the novel. It spoils everything. It spoils the ending. I read this foreword and I got to the end and was like, why did I buy this book? They were just going to tell me how it ended. Here's my pain. My pain is a gift to you to not read the foreword until you have read the entire book. And then if you're interested in it, go back and read it at the end. But yeah, unless you don't care about complete story arc spoilers, which we have not spoiled you on the ending of this book in this podcast. So, you know, if you really want to find out what happens.
I mean, I think I did, didn't I?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Well, I feel like, you know, our listeners are smart YA readers, so I think that will be fine.
I know. Also, it's been out for, you know,
it's been out for
years.
A million years. So
how many years is this?
1990.
What year is this right now?
We're in 2020. 30 years.
Oh, it's been out for 30 years. So spoilers are sort of like fair game. I just don't expect them when I pick up the book.
You know. Yeah. One of my favorite lines from the introduction, though, is Annette Curtis Claus says something that I really identify with, which is, I have always been in love with monsters. And I think that that's how she explains, you know, just her interest in vampire lore and things like that. And that is a thread that you will find in Vampires Never Get Old and a lot of our stories. So if you love monsters, we are here for it. Thank you guys for listening. We will be back with future episodes and more vampire goodness.